want to welcome you to the War Crimes Speaker Series. We run the series during the academic year. As you know, my name is Susana Sakotu. I know most of you. I direct the War Crimes Research Office here and teach in related areas. I think this is maybe our fourth speaker of the academic year. And we bring practitioners and experts in international criminal and humanitarian law to the school to talk with you about their work, about what it means to practice international law, what the challenges are, some of the struggles of practitioners and experts in the field. We are very, very fortunate to have with us today Judith Armada, who wears a variety and has worn a variety of hats. She's a lawyer, she's a journalist, she's a human rights advocate. She currently consults on international humanitarian law, human rights, and rule of law issues in various projects. Her recent work includes consultation on legal education in the West Bank and performance of an assessment of Iraqis' access to legal redress. Formerly, she's done a lot in her career, but she's directed, among those projects, she's directed rule of law projects in Serbia and Montenegro and a Kosovo war crimes documentation project in Macedonia. She has reported on international war crimes trials at the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the International Criminal Court, and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where she served as a legal liaison to the Tribunal for the Coalition for International Justice. Good colleagues of ours, who unfortunately are not around anymore, but they did an enormous amount of good work. They were D.C.-based for, I think, a decade before they closed the doors. Her book, Twilight of Impunity, which she'll hopefully be showing you today, The War Crimes Trial of Slobodan Milosevic, was published to critical acclaim by the Duke University Press in 2010. Judith has extensive policy and legislative and programmatic experience on, among other things, violence against women and children. So we are extremely fortunate to have her with us today. I've asked her to talk for maybe 20, 30 minutes, 20, 25 minutes, and then to open it up for questions from you all. Please feel free to come. There's still some more seats in the back here. So without further ado, let me turn it over to Judith, and thank you for being with us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Susana. Sometimes it wears me out to hear all those things that I participated in. It's like, so did I do that? No wonder I'm tired. I'm really only 25. Just look a little older. I wanted to. This is also always a difficult topic in some ways to talk about over lunch.
Yeah.
But bear with me, and we'll try to do this. I actually want to start out with something that's a little bit hard, but it's the reason that I believe that we have these war crimes tribunals, international tribunals. So I want to put this in perspective, and this is what I want to start with. It's in my book. B-1401, this is from the Yugoslav Tribunal and the trial of Milosevic, Slobodan Milosevic. B-1401 was a 17-year-old refugee when he and his family were caught in the maelstrom of war, ethnic cleansing, and mass executions that became known to the world as Srebrenica. When the Bosnian Serbs attacked the UN safe area on 6 July 1995, B-1401, along with other able-bodied Muslim men and boys, was faced with a decision to seek shelter at the UN base in Potočari among the women and children, or flee into the woods. Understandably, lacking confidence that the UN would protect them, B-1401, his father, his uncle, and other male relatives headed for the woods. They joined a column of 15,000 men, led by 1,000 to 3,000 Bosnian army troops, heading toward Bosnian-controlled territory. In fierce fighting, the Bosnian soldiers broke through enemy lines, leaving civilians and some of the soldiers behind. When Milosevic questioned the witness about the army's abandonment of civilians, he responded, "They had to save themselves. If they'd taken us, no one would have survived." The remaining civilians spent the night in the woods under heavy shell fire. B-1401 described a scene of extraordinary chaos. Men were wounded and dying. Some were hallucinating, and a few killed themselves rather than surrender. They did not know where they were. The witness lost contact with his father and never saw him again. Next day, the shelling let up, and Serb forces demanded that the column surrender. While some men headed deeper into the woods, many thousands walked toward Serbian forces with their hands raised. B-1401 described walking over corpses, seeing men with their faces and hands blown off from shells. He estimated that about 500 men were killed in the woods. After demanding that the men throw down their weapons, valuables, and German marks, their Serb captors crowded them onto trucks where they spent the night without food or water. The following morning, the men were crammed into a school building in Petkovci under even worse conditions and forced to repeat, "This is Serb land. It always was and always will be." The men were so thirsty they drank their own urine. As night fell, they were taken out in groups of 3 to 5, followed by the sound of gunfire. None returned. Soldiers later led the remaining men out, tying their hands and loading them onto a truck. The witness described feeling a sticky substance on his foot and seeing a large pile of corpses in front of the school. After a 5 to 10 minute ride, the truck stopped. Men were unloaded in groups of 5. Each time, the men remaining heard shots. B-1401 said they tried to avoid getting off the truck, knowing that they were going to be executed. Many begged for water. They did not want to die thirsty. The witness said he tried to hide too. "I just wanted to live another minute or two." When it was his turn, Serb soldiers ordered his group to find a place to lie down among the dead bodies. "Everything happened so fast," he told the court. "I thought I'd die soon and not suffer anymore, that my mama would never know where I am." The soldiers opened fire. B-1401 was shot in the right side. When the next group came and the shooting resumed, he was wounded again in his left foot. Later, he was hit once more. "He was suffering so much from his wounds," he testified, "that he wanted to cry out and beg to be killed. The moaning of the man next to him elicited a bullet in the head. The killing continued for another hour. His pain was so excruciating that B-1401 would never have tried to escape had it not been for another survivor. The two untied each other's hands with their teeth, crawled on their stomachs across the field of corpses, and reached the top of a hill. Next morning, they saw a yellow loader collecting a very large pile of dead bodies. Speaking of the trek through the woods with the other survivor, B-1401 testified, "He was the only one who knows how badly I suffered. I couldn't walk. He would leave me, then come back and beseech me to go on. I hurt so badly." After 4 days of traveling, they reached safety. Milosevic questioned the witness about the nature of the column of men, how many were armed, how many were soldiers, how many in the woods were killed in combat. The accused was seeking support for his defense that a large number of the Srebrenica dead had died while fighting. Yet if 500 men died fighting in the woods, at least 6,500 more remained to be accounted for. When Milosevic questioned the young man about apparent discrepancies in identifying the execution site, B-1401 responded, "It happened during the night. You'll never be able to understand the feeling when one is taken out to be executed." As one of the prosecutors later wrote, "When this boy testified, something happened in the courtroom. We were all, judges, prosecutors, amici, choking back emotion. It was as if his having passed through that experience imparted a quality to him that impacted us all." So that's hard stuff, and these war crimes trials do have hard stuff. They're, that's the nature of them, and you have to, you know, be able to find places to sustain yourself and support yourself while you're observing or defending or prosecuting or whatever it is that you're doing, judging, being involved in them. But I read that because it was true, and it will be true in other tribunals or other trials at the International Criminal Court, the permanent court. But it was true in the ICTY that the victims were often forgotten because they weren't there. The trial was held in The Hague, in the Netherlands, thousands of miles away from Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, Montenegro, Kosovo. And, you know, villagers and, I mean, nobody could really afford to come to the trials. And so what they saw sometimes was it televised. But the people at the trial didn't see them and didn't feel that impact. And I think it had repercussions. I noticed, for my part, I worked a lot with the press because I was observing the trial and writing about it. And you notice that there was this sort of forgetfulness of victims, that they were focused on Milosevic and his antics and, you know, what was going on with that whole thing. But the victims were kind of not thought about very much. And it was particularly true when Milosevic insisted on representing himself. And it caused lots of delays. It caused tremendous problems with the court. The judges were going out of their minds. The chief judge found it very difficult to control Milosevic. He was argumentative, repetitive. He most often didn't even stay on subject. He was intent on doing his own thing, which was trying to make a historical political statement and to sort of contribute to his own myth, the myth of Milosevic. So his right to defend himself was an issue, and the court let him do it. They said, okay, you know, these are very complex trials, very serious issues, but, you know, go ahead, defend yourself. We appoint amici, friends of the court, so that they can, you know, tell us if you're missing something that you should be defending on. It caused tremendous problems in the trial. And at one point, when it was raised, you know, it became prominent again, the press basically was saying, well, you know, he should just be allowed to do whatever he wants to. I mean, the judge can just sit back and say, you've got so much time, you know, do a dance if you want to, you know, stage a play, do a debate. It's his, you know, his right. Well, where are the victims in that, you know? Where are the reasons for the trial? And so that's kind of what I mean about needing to maintain and focus on the victims. With trials of leaders in particular, they're very difficult because leaders who have been the head of state in their country, head of state dictator in their country for many, many years, don't take easily to being put into a situation where they have to answer something, where they have to obey the law, where they have to obey procedures. And so they're not particularly responsive and appropriate in the courtroom. Usually, the first thing that, of course, is done inappropriately, I think, is to challenge the legitimacy of the court. And in Milosevic, he did challenge the legitimacy of the court, and the court ruled on it and said, you know, it's a UN court. It was established through Chapter 7 of the UN, and so it's legitimate. That doesn't mean that then, you know, the accused goes along with that and just says, okay, fine, you know, now we'll continue. Milosevic told the court that he didn't intend to defend himself, that he intended to put NATO on trial, you know, put the West on trial for what they had done, he felt they had done to his country, and to defend the underdog against the hegemony of the United States and NATO and European powers. And the court still let him defend himself. And I think that was their first mistake. If somebody says, I'm not going to defend myself, then you say, okay, we'll appoint somebody to defend you, because that's what we're here about. At any rate, what happened is that Milosevic was a very sick man. He was sick before he came to The Hague, before they sent him to The Hague. He had a very serious heart condition. And during the trial, of course, he was under a lot of stress. And continually, the trial would have to be adjourned for a while so that he could recover, so that his blood pressure could go down from 260 or whatever it was. And he ultimately, instead of having like 5 days of trial, 8 hours a day or 6 hours a day, he ended up with 3 days a week of about 4.5 hours, with longer periods of adjournment because he couldn't come to court because he was sick. So that was one problem that made the trial last over 4 years. And it would have lasted longer, of course, but as you know, Milosevic died before it was over from a heart attack. The other problem, of course, is that he really didn't have the skills to defend himself. He didn't intend to, and he didn't have the skills. But he was a great interrogator. He was really good at interrogating. And it was a problem, particularly for victims, and to come before the man who had run their country as a dictator, had absolute power. And here they come from their village, never having probably been out of their village or certainly not out of Yugoslavia, and appear before this court room that looks like something from, you know, the 22nd century, and in a very strange environment in Holland without their support system with them, and to confront him and to tell their stories. These people were incredibly brave, and he was abusive in his questioning. particularly with victim witnesses and particularly with Kosovar Albanians, and particularly with victim witnesses who were uneducated. He was collegial and respectful if it was an international interlocutor. And I think that that's a real problem. There's no need to victimize somebody twice. It's hard enough for them to come. I absolutely believe in defendants' rights. I'd fight for them to the end. But the judge can ask the questions. Milosevic or any defendant, if they're defending themselves, can put their questions down and allow the judge to ask them in a respectful way. So that was another problem with the trial. It wasn't just Milosevic. I talk about him because I sat through that trial for way too many years, I think. But certainly other leadership trials, Saddam Hussein, and that trial I will not defend. I think that trial was maybe travesty is probably appropriate. But when he challenged the jurisdiction of the court, I think he should have won on that. And the trial itself was truly a circus and a disgrace to law and the rule of law. But there have been, of course, other leadership trials, and they'll continue. Charles Taylor, who was he was the president of Liberia and contributed mightily to the war in Sierra Leone, where hundreds of thousands of people were killed and many of them mutilated through having their limbs cut off, all over blood diamonds, really. He did not choose to defend himself. But what he did right off was he refused to come to court. Refused to come to court, and he fired his attorney. And it caused a one-year delay in the trial, but it didn't end the trial. And the trial has now concluded, and they're waiting for a judgment. So, you know, that was a pretty appropriate trial. I've recently been watching at 4 o'clock in the morning one of the trials at the International Criminal Court. And I have to say, I'm impressed with the judges there. The chief judge pretty much runs the show. There's a panel of three judges, and he's very courteous. He's very firm, and he knows the law. He's very respectful of the witnesses. There's three attorneys defending the accused, Thomas Lubanga, and he's on trial for using child soldiers in the Congo. So, you know, I think that people have started learning something. In the Milosevic trial, the problem was that Milosevic and the chief judge fought all the time. The chief judge would, you know, have to stop him from doing whatever he was doing, abusing a witness or repetitive questioning or making a speech, you know, all the things that he repeatedly did. So you constantly had Judge May saying, Mr. Milosevic can't do that, or shutting off his microphone and stopping him. The problem was, I was really shocked when some friends who were lawyers came and watched the trial, and they said, boy, that judge is really bad. You know, he is really bad. He's so hard on the defendant. And I thought, gee, it's not from where I'm sitting. But that's what it looked like. And it made it look like that Milosevic was kind of winning and that he was sort of being abused. So the second Judge May died about halfway through the trial. I still think stress contributed to he had a brain cancer, but of course I can't. It's just my private thing. And then Judge Robinson took over. He wasn't particularly a good manager either. He was more laid back in some ways. The judge they appointed to take Judge May's place was Judge Ian Bonamy from Scotland, and he was very good at raising the issues and catching Milosevic out, because one of the things he often did was to misrepresent what was going on. He would a witness would answer a question, and he would repeat it back to him wrong, and then say, you just said. And if you weren't on top of that, it could get very confusing for the witness and certainly for the court. And there was an occasion when that happened, when a witness had testified about something and there was a gap of about, I don't know, there was a gap between his next testimony, and then Milosevic came back with, you said this, and it confused the court, because well, I guess I won't go into that because it gets too complicated. But he was a great manipulator, Milosevic was. And it's one of the things that the courts who do these kinds of cases really have to be aware of is these people have no respect for law. And I'm not, you know, I'm not talking about everybody. There are people who went to these courts and were innocent or you weren't the leaders, though they're usually high up because that's what the international courts focus on. But certainly the leaders who have been dictators, like Milosevic was, they don't have any respect for the law. They didn't have to. They made it. They made the law. They were above the law. And they applied it as they wanted to. So they don't have any regard for the rules that say, well, you can't enter fraudulent documents. And he did. You know, I mean, there's a whole list of things that that Milosevic did when he was defending himself, supposedly. Fraudulent documents, witnesses who had clearly been coached. There was a whole string of evidence where witness after witness after witness came in and said, no, the Kosovo Albanians were never chased out of Kosovo. You know, they left because, you know, they wanted to, and they left because there was a, they were told to create a humanitarian catastrophe. None of them were injured. Now, if anybody, you may not have watched this. This is many years ago, but watching on television, or certainly the people who were there on the ground, and I got there a little, I wasn't watching the refugee flows, but I certainly saw the tent cities and was involved in that. These people were not faking something to get, you know, news so that NATO could come and intervene. They were driven out. Almost a million people were driven out in a very short period of time through a variety of means, including murder, burning, you know, your property, burning your identification papers, rape, all sorts of things just to move them out, and that was the plan. But here you had witnesses that came in and said, well, you know, they were faking it. I saw this boy who was, you know, when the TV cameras were there, he would lie down on the stretcher and pretend like he was, you know, in serious trauma, and as soon as the TV cameras went away, then, you know, he would perk up. He was fine. He walked away. You know, and one story like that might be, you know, you could think about that, but five stories, sort of the same theme, make it a little unbelievable. And Milosevic didn't tend to rely on, he was making a show for, would you tell me when it's?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I don't want to chat.
Maybe another 5 minutes.
Okay, because I really want to get into asking questions and that sort of thing. You think I can see that? Okay, thank you. Let's see. I've forgotten what I was saying there. I interrupted myself. Well, let's go on to just finishing up here with the. It's really important for the court to the chief judge to manage the courtroom, to take control of the courtroom. It's hard to do. It's an incredible challenge. Judges need to really be trained and prepared to do this. They need to have a background in dealing with complex litigation. The judges at the ICTY were a mix, and because they didn't have to have any trial experience whatsoever. They didn't have to have been a judge, really. There was a whole slew of them who were diplomats who, you know, were, their estate was ready to kind of kick them upstairs, and so, well, this would be a nice thing for the end of his career. And they didn't know anything about criminal procedure, anything like that. So how to manage a courtroom, and especially with these kinds of cases, there have been some in the United States, for example, you know, where the judges were confronted with a very difficult accused and needed to find ways to deal with that. But for the most part, that doesn't happen. So, and the judges' tools are, you know, they're somewhat limited. If you're dealing with somebody who's facing life in prison, holding them in contempt of court and giving them prison time or more jail time, they're already in jail at that time, doesn't usually affect them very much. The leaders know that that's where they're going to spend pretty much the rest of their lives. Not pretty much, the rest of their lives. So you can't use that. Judge May would turn off Milosevic's microphone when he got out of hand. There was the some of the things that the court could do that it hasn't done is it could take away privileges that the accused have in how many telephone calls they can make or how many times they can go play ping pong or, you know, taking TV away from them or something. You know, but there are privileges that they could take away from them. And at some point, when an accused who's self-representing continues to be obstructionist, then the court should step in and appoint counsel. And that, in fact, is what the Milosevic court attempted to do. They appointed counsel. Milosevic boycotted it, his trial. His witnesses boycotted. Actually, he came to trial, but his witnesses boycotted the trial. And since it was his defense case, there was really nothing to... The appointed counsel didn't have any witnesses to call because none of them would come to court. A handful, but none of the ones that were really significant witnesses. And so you had people who were former, you know, officials in Canada, you know, in their governments and stuff, who were defying the court and refusing to come to court. They could have used and perhaps would have gotten to use contempt powers against those people who were refusing to come to court. But what happened is that the appeals chamber overturned the trial court and gave Milosevic back his stage. So that is regrettable, and they've continued to do that in other trials. They haven't backed up their trial court, so it's very difficult at the ICTY to manage cases. And I'm just... I think I'll stop there. Because I can finish up with the rest of it. So let's get into some discussion.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you so much, Judith. I think we will open it up. I want to take the prerogative of moderator to just ask you the first question, which kind of dovetails into the last comment you made about self-representation. There isn't an unqualified right to represent oneself before these tribunals, right?
Right.
I mean, it hasn't just been the ICTY. Even the appeals chamber that overturned the trial chamber did lay out, it did hold that the right to represent oneself is not unqualified. So what do you think is the real issue? Why is it so difficult for the court to impose limitations? I mean, the court could not simply impose or assign counsel, but ask the defendant if he or she is too disruptive to follow proceedings from his jail cell and to talk with counsel from his jail cell about things that are going on at trial. Why is this so difficult to do?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is certainly with the Milosevic court, they bent over backwards to not seem unfair. They didn't want to seem unfair. The problem, of course, when you're dealing with a manipulative person and who's been a bully and all of his life, is that he's going to any kind of thing that he thinks of as weakness, he will use to his advantage. The court wanted him to participate and not sit there. Or he thought the more that they were, deferred to him, that he would actually come around and participate appropriately. He didn't do it. So that was one of the reasons, is that the court has, it's a fine line they have to walk between, being too lenient or too harsh. And in the Milosevic case, they erred on the side of being too lenient. The other issue is, finding out what is the essential right there. Well, the essential right is to a fair trial. And I think courts have gotten confused about that sometimes. And more, I think the public gets confused about that, certainly in the United States, where we have constitutional backing for the right to represent yourself, though it's not unlimited. But when the fair trial is really what it's all about, and you have, again, as I said earlier, the press is standing there saying, well, let him just do what he wants to. It's his trial. If he wants to debate or, stage a play, let him do it. That's not a fair trial for the victims, and it's not a fair trial for the public. And the public has an interest in these kinds of trials. They're crimes against humanity. That means they're crimes against, what we know is human, our human community. And so let a defendant make a mockery is totally inappropriate. But I think that confusion has entered into it at some point.
Let's open it up and take some questions. Yeah. And maybe you could state your name and kind of...
Yeah, I'm not in this field. How compare this to what you've read of Nuremberg or the Eichmann trial, in terms of procedure and how they were conducted?
Well, you know, it certainly has been a... the ICTY has been built on Nuremberg, built on the Tokyo tribunals. And there, you know, there were defense counsel at Nuremberg and in Tokyo. There certainly accused got out of line at different points, but the court had much more control over their courtrooms in Nuremberg, for example. I think that, you know, we're in a very different age now, and the court could say that Nuremberg was victor's justice. I mean, I think that it was a fair trial, but you could say that, and a lot of people have. I don't think there's any way you can really say that about the ICTY. It wasn't the people who conquered or bested Serbia, for example, that were trying the cases. Plus, there were cases against Bosniaks, Kosovars, Croatians, as well as Serbians. So it was a very different kind of a venue. Just kind of briefly.
Wasn't there someone who was recently arrested, I think, in Ohio, that has now been sent back to Europe to be tried?
Yeah.
The Second World War. I'm not sure where the tribunal is.
Well, it's probably a state. It would be the state of Germany or Israel, maybe. I didn't hear that. I'm sorry.
It's a hand up here. Yeah.
You mentioned how important it is for the judges to be good managers of their courtroom. Have you seen an improvement, like, in the tribunal since the ICTY, and maybe not only the qualities of the judges, but, like, the considerations that are taken into account when selecting judges? And if you could just speak up briefly about what, like,
I think it has. I think there has been an improvement. And just comparing the ICTY to the International Criminal Court, the permanent court, and I've only watched a couple of trials there, but in those trials, I've been impressed with the way the judges were managing their courtrooms. And they still have, you know, very obstreperous accused, I'm sorry, to deal with. But I think they've dealt with them much better. There are a variety of different courts, ad hoc courts, and that have happened sort of since or after the ICTY and ICTR, Rwanda Court, was started. And those, I think pretty much the court in Sierra Leone did a good job. And again, they're continually building on, you know, they're not unaware of what it's like to now, I think, the judges who are there, to expect that an accused, a high-level accused, is going to be difficult to manage. And so there is much more awareness of that. And I think the selection has improved, though I'm not sure, I'm sorry to say, if they have improved the selection criteria at the ICC. I know that it was way too wide open at the ICTY, but certainly their training, the selection of judges to be chief judges and to handle those cases, I think, has improved. And we're still at a very baby stage, and I think that we'll continue to see that some very accomplished people are involved at the ICC, you know, have become involved in this whole area of international criminal law.
I think now we see in the ICC context, there are sort of two lists, two different categories of criteria. One is folks who have sort of substantive knowledge in international criminal law and procedure, but can come more from kind of an academic or policy kind of background. And the other one is, the other list is from practitioners who have, experience in criminal law, either as judges or prosecutors or defendants. defense, defense counsel. And so now you see, and elections for judges are coming up again very soon. And states have to put forward people that meet one or the other of the criteria listed in either one of those categories. So I think it is improving. And also, with all of you who are taking now not just practice, you know, criminal, your clinics here and are having experience in the courtroom, but also are enthusiastic in taking courses in international law, international criminal law, you're the sort of beginning of a generation that has both. I think when these tribunals started, right, that you really got either folks who just did domestic litigation or folks who kind of knew at a theoretical level about international law. And here now I think you're getting more and more a generation of folks who have experience in both camps. And I think that's the trend, even with the ad hocs. Mm-hmm. Let's open the floor again for other questions. Oh, hey, Teresa.
I'm Teresa Phelps. I'm one of the faculty here. I'm really interested in women victims of the ICTY. I mean, obviously, the court was breaking ground in prosecuting certain kinds of crimes in certain kinds of ways. And I'm interested in your observation of their treatment and handling and special things in place, you know, particularly.
Very good question. The ICTY, because women lawyers were involved, who were very aware that rape victims, for example, had a difficult time in the courtroom, they pushed the ICTY to have a special gender specialist. They had a victim witnesses unit that would work with the women that were there for them. But I think that the gender specialist also helped to sort of raise the consciousness of the judges and the prosecutors. One of the positive things is that the ICTY established for the first time that rape was a standalone war crime. You know, and so that was a real accomplishment. Also, you know, the procedural rules are the same pretty much as in the United States. There's a rape shield laws. You can't get into a rape victim's background, all of that sort of thing. There are confidentiality procedures so that a rape victim can testify, you know, without her name, with voice distortion, and face, can't see her. And so there were those kinds of protections. It's still very difficult, I think, and I know that in the Milosevic trial, we didn't know anything about sexual assault testimony, not throughout the whole trial. We never heard a word of it. It was all done confidentially. And then afterwards, at some point, the court released some transcripts at least, so you could read it. And at that point, I think that even though their consciousness had been raised, that it was difficult for the courts, the judge and the prosecutor, to really understand what kind of questioning is off limits when you're talking with a rape victim. And there was one woman who was testifying, and Milosevic was badgering her. You didn't believe her. You're a liar, all of that sort of thing. And the court let him continue. They let him continue far longer than he should have. So, and the prosecutor sort of stood up and said something and then said, well, we don't really know. This is a new field, and I'm just sort of raising this for you to think about. And the court said, yeah, well, he can go ahead and question for more for a while. So there's been improvement. With the ICC, they have a much more established and developed victims unit, as well as provision for victims to be represented by counsel and participate in the trials. So I'm not sure exactly how that's all working out, because I haven't don't have a survey of that, but victims do participate. Large victims groups have hired counsel that can, make statements on behalf of the victims. They can submit motions and those sorts of things, and they can seek damages for them. So there is some movement that way. The case that I'm most involved with right now doesn't have sexual assault as one of the charges, though it should have been. One of the other cases, the Katanga case, is the first one that started at the ICC that focuses on sexual violence, sexual assault, sexual slavery, and that sort of thing. So that's going to be an interesting trial to sort of watch and see what they do with that.
Thank you. Do you have a question? Others? I've answered all your questions about trying at the state. Now, here's one.
So you had said, if I followed correctly, the ICC had your
stamp, maybe.
Oh,
maybe,
sorry.
So that Judith can see. Yeah.
And I'm Emily Rose, and I'm a student. You had said that the victims had hired attorneys who could speak on their behalf and submit motions. How much is that happening in courts? I know that's a popular, or, you know, a common thing in certain, like, civil law countries.
Yeah. It's happening at the ICC in pretty much every case. The ICC now has three trials, I think, that are ongoing, and others that are at the pretrial stage. So in all of those three trials, I'm pretty sure that the victims have representatives that are participating. And I know in the Lubanga trial, they've been very actively involved.
And does that maybe feel more effective or less effective than kind of having maybe individual victims representing themselves, like each individual mm-hmm. victim?
Well, just management-wise, I don't think they can have individual victims participating in, you know, there's so many of them. And so even the ones that get represented, a group that gets represented is a representative group. You know, we're talking about often hundreds of thousands or 10,000 or whatever. So, there are limitations to it, of course, but it does get their interest. Represent their interests, and some of the if damages are assessed, they are put into a fund for victims. That I'm not sure all of the criteria for when victims groups can draw on those, but they're meant more broadly for to deal with trauma that victims have gone through.
The other court that where victims participate is the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, and they have a slightly different scheme, but it's the same sort of thing. They get to, they're usually represented. They're now represented by one co-lead lawyer, Cambodian International, and in the case number two, there's over 2,100 victims are being represented by this team of lawyers. But for the same reasons Judith just mentioned, I mean, management of their participation when you're talking about 2,000 people, you can't have a single, you know, everyone participate and speak during the proceedings. But the sort of your other question about whether it's working and how well it's working, I think it's early to tell, right? And we don't have a lot of data yet about how meaningful participation has been in either one of these tribunals, because we're still, in the case, there's no case that has come to conclusion before the ICC, and only one case has been tried to conclusion in the Extraordinary Chambers. So we're still sort of in a too early a stage to make broad assessments. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excuse me.
My name is Katarina Mell. I'm an international visiting scholar here. And I think the ICTY represents a very special case on confronting the right to fair trial and the right to truth from the society, from the whole society, and from victims. Considering that he was that, I mean, the that was a victim. The other accused during the trial. Because Claudia Ponti, after the death, said, okay, the justice was not made because of his death, but at least we have exhumations, we have facts, we have many things that before was not even known. And I don't know if you can tell more about this, because I think this is a very unique trial on this trying to best the best point of equilibrium between the two rights, because it's not only saying that Wasabi can say the historical truth, because mm-hmm. he actually tried to do it, but mm-hmm. how to manage these two principles or two rights that are in conflict during this trial.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I've got this right. You're right. One of the major issues that came out of the Milosevic trial was the self-representation issue, and the other point is that the trial didn't end. You know, I think that his participation as a pro se accused contributed to that. At what point does the court limit, you know, an accused right? One of the things the court did that was smart was that they appointed amici curiae right from the beginning. Amici got confused about what their role was, and they sort of tended to think they were defense attorneys. It is confusing. I mean, what do you do when the court says to you, raise issues that he hasn't raised so that, you know, we make sure he gets a fair trial? That sounds a lot like defend the guy, you know. Different amici responded differently to that. And certainly when one of the amici took the position and would say things like, well, we know that the Bosnian and Croatian wars were civil wars. Well, that's an issue, you know, in the case, and certainly that wasn't the position that the prosecution was taking, and so he's acting like a defense counsel there. But having an amici, somebody that sits through the whole trial, then if there is a need to step in and appoint counsel, you've got somebody there that, knows the facts, and you don't have to stop for a year or whatever to get somebody up to speed. It was very difficult for this amici. Milosevic didn't want them as his counsel, and he refused to cooperate with them, at least on a certain level. And so one of the lead amici, Stephen Kay, who's a very qualified Queen's counsel in Britain, said, I want out of here. You know, Your Honors, we really can't do anything. Our hands are tied, so please, you know, dismiss us as his counsel. And the court said, no, I won't do that. And he said, well, I'm walking. You can't keep me here. He said, my bar association says I can leave. And the court said, well, our bar association says you can't. And so it got really head on, and ultimately the amici decided to stay. And Milosevic, even though he gave the appearance of not really using them, he did. He used them. We know more about that now after the trial, that he did rely on them quite a bit to make his legal motions in particular, but he conferred with them as well. So could you say a little bit more? I'm not sure I'm hitting your answering your question.
So the role of victims, that was very important and at the same time limited because of the hate distance and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's considering the victims and the society to the right, their right to mm-hmm. truth about what happened. Because I remember reading something on New York Times from one of the survivors from the Srebrenica case,
Yeah.
It was like finally the truth came.
Yeah.
There was a plea bargain or something.
Yeah.
It was his sensation that he didn't have any more to justify that
mm-hmm.
his family or his
mm-hmm.
friends were killed. And,
yeah.
And the notion of justice is a fair trial. How
yeah.
to manage this in a tribal way.
That was Amir Suljagic. He was a wonderful, is. He was a reporter at that time and did an excellent job. But it was the first time that anybody had, you know, it was a plea by one of the, I think it was the military intelligence, head of military intelligence on the ground at Srebrenica, who entered a plea. And he didn't plead to genocide, but he did essentially plead to persecution based on ethnicity. And it was very important for Amir and for a lot of other victims, I think. The balance, you know, there are people who say, well, it's not a truth, you know, the tribunals are not there to find historical truth. And they're not, you know, they're trying an individual. So even when the whole trial is finished, you can't say, well, Serbia was responsible for this war, you know, or Bosnia was, or Croatia, whatever. You can't say that. But it does... facts come out, and there were incredible documents, not the same, probably not the quantity that there were at Nuremberg, but there were a lot of documents that came out in the Milosevic trial and are still coming out. There's still one of the issues was, this was a very interesting issue, the Supreme Defense Council, which is made up of the head of the army and the president, and well, actually three presidents, it directs the army. And their minutes of what was going on during the wars were, Serbia wouldn't let go of them. They wouldn't give them to the tribunal. And finally, there was, Carla Del Ponte kept trying to get them, and she is accused of sort of making a deal that we'll give you these minutes if you promise not to make them public, and that she agreed to that. She says she didn't agree to that. She said if it's reasonable and that, you know, it affects your national interest. Well, that wasn't the standard that they used, but the court let them, kept them confidential and introduced those defense counsel minutes. And what she has said, and other anonymous lawyers who saw them, is that there's proof in there that Milosevic and Serbia were actively involved in the Srebrenica genocide, that they have responsibility there. The reason that Serbia wanted that kept confidential is that they were being sued at the International Court of Justice by Bosnia for genocide, and they were asking big bucks as a result. Well, they didn't come out. The ICJ did not ask for those, even though Bosnia said you need to request these minutes, you need to request this information. The court said, no, we've got enough. And then they found against Bosnia, they didn't award any damages at all. So Serbia won that. Those Supreme Defense Council minutes are now public record, though most people I know haven't seen them and haven't been able to dig through them to find out if that, in fact, was the truth, that I'm going off on a tangent from what you said. Is that okay?
Thank you. I think there's one other question on the back here. Yeah.
Yeah. My name is Lasagna.
Speak up just a little bit. We have a fan in the back.
Well, you know, it's a good argument, but the ICJ didn't ask for them, you know, and Bosnia didn't have the power itself. It asked the court to, request these records, and the court wouldn't do it. So, yeah, I mean, there are, unfortunately, those are one of the kinds of limitations that you run up against at this point. And what was I going to say? I think that, you know, just kind of finishing up around the whole issue of victims and how they feel about the trial or felt about the Milosevic trial, that it was mixed. You know, some felt they were, you know, all of this for nothing, you know. And others felt, well, he spent 5 years in jail, and he was confronted by some of those he harmed. And those confrontations were incredible. You know, some of them were absolutely incredible. There was one by an elderly former school principal, I believe, who testified that his son had come to him, and this is during the Kosovo War, his son had come to him and said, early in the morning, and said, "Father, my life is over. They've killed my wife and children." And so he gave his testimony, and at the end of his testimony, he turned to the court and he said, "May I say something, Your Honors?" Well, no. You know, the court never lets that happen. It's one of the limitations that the victims always feel. I didn't get to tell my story. You know, I wanted to tell my story, and they're just answering yes or no questions. And the court, for some reason, said, yeah, you know, go ahead. And he just turned and looked at Milosevic. He looked him in the eye, and he said, "I just want to ask you, Mr. Milosevic, don't you have any human feelings? How could you kill women and children?" And you could have heard a pin drop in that courtroom. But that was the kind of confrontation that I think made some people feel that there was some justice and made the victims who came to court and gave testimony feel that they weren't just there for themselves. They were there for, you know, all the people who had died and who had otherwise suffered as a result. So
Thank you so much. If there's no any other questions, if not, please help me thank Judith Armato. Thank you. Thank you.
If anybody wants to have information about the Torah, this is just about the book. It took forever to write, but I never thought it would actually come out in where I could substantively see it.
Right.
So anyway, pass them around.
Okay. Have time.